Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about terracotta warriors. I'm going to give a little talk about this while I'm walking up to different places. Podcast while walking, in actual fact. So terracotta warriors. Warriors are obviously troops. Scary people. They're not with you, they're against you. These are scary people, and these are terracotta. So they're clay pottery. Terracotta. So pottery is basically sort of nanoparticles, so small that they have a huge surface area, absorb water. When you fire them up, some of the particles turn to a glass, and you get a ceramic mix. And of course, these are the terracotta warriors. Now, you've probably heard of them. Obviously, exported by the Chinese government. And the overall story is that a farmer in 1974 was digging his field, found a bit of a head, a terracotta head of a warrior, and dutifully reported it to his commune thing. And the government took it over, thank goodness, and they had this sort of a whole mountain where they discovered the terracotta warriors. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on it. So if you can imagine a pot, but the pot, which is a pottery person standing or 1.5 meters high, a bit taller than natural height, confronting you, looking very Chinese, in ancient garb with the headdress and stuff like that. And there's a fair number of these. There's 8,000 of these. So a little bit more to the story. So the thread of the story I'm going to take is give you a tour of Chinese emperors. So China is a very sort of interesting place. So around 2000 BC, so this is way before recorded Greek history, the Babylonian time and stuff like that, there was a mythical yellow emperor, the very first emperor, who was given the mandate from heaven. So the heavens, so you start to actually understand there's a sort of a multiverse, so the real verse and the external verse, and rather than just people being royal forever and God coming down and pointing something, they actually selected an individual, an emperor, and they've given holy powers, and it's a little bit different from the West in terms of that the heaven is actively running the place, and sort of rather than in the West you've got free will and God's going, trying to steer remotely by creating blocks and burning people and create good luck and stuff like that. So you can infer it one step. The Chinese have a single step that God is directly controlling, and the actual emperor is the actual, the heavens actually operating. So, yeah. And this meant that with such short time delay, this is not from the exhibition, the Chinese astronomy meant that if they saw something that wasn't a portent of something to happen in the future, that was right live now. That was God saying, this person's stuffed up, I'm just telling the population that I've moved my heavenly mandate. And so the heavenly mandate was something perceived by the people. And so you had to, it's sort of this, the heavenly mandate perceived by the people meant that you had to be godlike, and therefore you had to be bigger than bigger. It's sort of like the Donald Trump back there. Now, there's a mythical yellow emperor, lost in the mist of times, and it gives the sort of the emperor mandate of heaven franchise, and you get the ancient philosophies, Confucianism, all those ones, 800, around the time of Pythagoras, or earlier than that, coming through, and we come up to 280 BC before Christ, and with the Qin dynasty, and this is like the first historical emperor for which there's historical evidence, including obviously the entombed warriors. This sounds a little bit fascist. It's their idea is that emperor did actually build a wall, and the wall was to keep out emperor. So you get the there were barrier walls, and he conquered all the regions of what is now China. Obviously, we go not Tibet. That's the China is China. We should have called China China Plus. That is, that would really irritate them. So we acknowledge China. That's China Plus. Plus the lands is subjugated. But if you take away Tibet and the Uyghurs, and I suppose Mongolia, he conquered that central section, brought it together. And now I'm just going to have to stop now as I drop in on this person. Okay, so I've got some decency. It's a bit, we've had daylight saving, so although it's this is in Australia, though it's an hour later, these people are still sleeping in, and I have a sort of a modicum of sanity not to disturb sleeping in people to chat about trivia with them. That would really piss them off, wouldn't it? Okay, now let's get going. We've got the first Qin emperor, a bit, if you can imagine, a Donald Trump, but he, and sort of Donald Trump slash your mega dictator. Now, looking around, there's a whole lot of technology 200 BC which would absolutely blow away anything we had in the Western world. Now, the interesting thing is that in the Western world, we had the Mediterranean, which is sort of like a big mega superhighway, where you just get a ship and go along, and so you had sailing technology with the weathers and stuff like that. China, if you look at it, has got these natural internal barriers for which you need organization to move. So if you're going to move from here to there, you can't just get a ship and then suddenly go there. You've got to actually build bridges, get a whole lot of bureaucracy to move anything around, and it means that there's a lot of information about, and they had such things as crossbows. So the crossbows really came into Europe, well, they weren't in 1066, say 12, around the time of Leonardo da Vinci, that's Renaissance, somewhere into there the crossbow came out. So these had these crossbows a full 1,000 years before the West did, and they had military organization. And so you basically had a military super state under this person, where you could get your rank by killing people. So if at the end of the battle, you tally out who killed who, how many you killed, and the more you killed, the higher your rank, the rank got. And so that's a fairly easy to monitor system. It meant that people, you couldn't rise to a rank in peacetime. You had to actually go out there and do a bit of bloody murder, and you can imagine it's sort of like focus. It's a KPI, performance bonus of working with people. That's how it worked. And then this emperor, once you raise the bar to invading people, you had to get people. You had to, I think, basically occupational therapy of building a great Chinese infrastructure, roads, palaces, walls, armies, all done, canals, infrastructures, sort of we only see today. I suppose the comment nowadays, back then the Chinese people suffered, now the environment, the planet is suffering. That would be my comment on it at the moment. But they had a method which is not unfamiliar to us in the Western world, that not only if you disobeyed or didn't perform, you died and your entire support network got wiped out. Your family and friends got killed. So you can imagine saying, "Oh, Mum, I don't want to go and work for blah, blah, blah. Oh, look, I think you should, you should." Or in various Chinese dialects, because it's sort of like a brilliant idea of thinking the hard thought and actually killing everyone. And of course it's got thing going, and people obviously, it's one of these hard laws which don't have a sort of any safety valves. It's sort of like a pressure vessel. There's no safety valves. It can only just build up more and more pressure and get more and more intense. And so it's at the time, it's at the time that this comes to servicing, we change that this high intensity economy, which really had nowhere to go. Of course, what could they do? Well, they could do what the Mongols did about a century, sorry, the Mongol Empire expanded based on this massive brutality. It seems to us a brutality that you either surrender, or if you put up a fight, you all get killed. And that being said, is sort of genocide is possibly the Uyghur and the Myanmar. That type of stuff is still happening. And that is, you all get killed. However, look, I even see that in elements of Australian society. You're either part of the party system, a political party, or things really happen bad for you. We're going to stand back, and something is bad's happening, and you're not part of the party apparatus. It's sort of like this second-tier justice system. And even though we're appalled by it in China, it does exist in Australia. A bit more subtly, that is, if some of the right political link connections having a hard time, they get massive amounts of support and things happen for them. If they're on the wrong side of the fence, or they've been flagged as being the wrong side of the fence, they will find it just very hard. The government departments won't work for them, there'll be long delays and things like this. And it's not necessarily that they understand, it'll be that they're associated with someone they want to squash, or there'll be a asset that they want that someone is holding, and so people around them will all lose. So it's a lot. It's a basically, I suppose, you knew where you stood back at this day. And so this entire emperor, now you've got to also recognize in the fact that I think the Romans projected power, fire, architecture and statues and dress code and so this, the projection of power required royal tours, and you see the royal tours being along happens right up to the 1700s. This is the royal people go around the place, and there's also the royalty tour places. It's still an amazing situation now. Back then, and now, it would be a way of getting on top of associating your business with royalty, and just, you know, part of, you know, if you, the establishment was coming through town, and it was a way for people who had something which is a bit on the edge, to make an establishment if it did something for the Royal Tour. Now, as he went round, this is the Emperor Qin, Q-I-N, so Kuo is Ch and Qin of China. As he went round the place, he sent out his messengers to search the kingdom far and wide for not the Philosopher's Stone, but the Elixir of Eternal Life. Now, there is this hunt, as I think in the West they were looking for something which should turn anything to gold. There was the idea of eternal life, and this supposedly spurred the innovation which came up with gunpowder, however that goes into it. But it's an important thing, this sort of centralizing want. And you could say similar, a similar thing is happening in the West. We have this idea of sending people to Mars. What is that about? You know, how is that ever going to actually help Joe Bloggs on the ground, who has got no air to breathe, no food to eat? How is that going to help? And it's a similar thing. So you've got Elon Musk wanting to go to Mars, so that when we all get fucked, at least he can be there with his mates. I doubt that he's going to pick up disabled people from the streets of Los Angeles and Mexican refugees and say, hey, come to Mars and beat the asteroid. No, I think it'll be his type of stuff. So there's a similar thing with the Emperor going around the place trying to find the stuff. And in a similar way, this quest is the key to going forward. It means that your intelligence officers are about the place, and they happen to say, they're knocking on your door, and you're going, what the fuck's going on? Oh, you want the cure for eternal life? Of course, what happened is that they got more and more whack tours, and this emperor began to slowly poison himself with different elixirs. The age of 52, which is ancient by those standards, he had so much mercury, he carked it. Now, at this stage, given the the heavenly mandate, it had to be bigger, sort of Disney proportions. And so there's several layers of entombment. And the first people who got entombed were the servants and stuff like that. Now, you can imagine, I can imagine that people wanting to actually run the system in an entomb. You want their jobs, so you... Oh, well, if you're really serious, you'll get entombed. I don't know, a bit hard. There's a sort of... often these things, when it happens, they're so involved in society, they go into a trance-like state and merrily entomb themselves. It's sort of hard to know. The Egyptians used to entomb people. Then you had the full-scale army, which is sort of extremely lifelike. However, there was still some sort of geometric creep. Now, and it was mass production, 8,000. There's only 10 archetypal head types, which are bunged on all the people, and then they were modified with bits of clay for the moustaches and beards and so forth. And then there was the scale thing that the higher rank were, the actual physically bigger were. So there's roughly a 50% scale thing. So a general 6'6" and the diminutive foot soldier's only 5 foot. You know, there's a fair difference there. They're all, I don't know, I suppose pretty, for 280 AD, so BC, it's pretty good what they've got. So that's your main army, so it's your servants entombed, your main army entombed, and then they have entombed a fun park. So this is over several acres, several kilometres, square kilometres, dug out a canal and made a clay representation. So there's entombed concubines, entombed geese, everything's set up for this emperor to have a fun time. Entombed. Okay, and we'll just start this in a little while because I'm going off now to my next stop. So you've got this fully kitted out army of 8,000 troops, and this is cavalry and various generals and actually sort of supply officers and administrators, and obviously a fair number of soldiers, all in ranks. I'll just describe how, and they're all coloured and armed with real arms and not with real clothes, but the clothes were painted, all painted. And I suppose it should be a bit of a spoiler alert. They discovered that they'd come out, unearthed from the ground, fully coloured, and then to their horror, their colours would fade within hours. And so until they've worked out how to actually preserve it properly, they're going to actually they've halted excavation. You can imagine someone has said stop, and so they've got enough to actually show around the place. And I'll give you how they were actually what happened after they were entombed, but there's another sort of very interesting thing I find in terms of that there is a half-size army of chariots and things. This is so for the defence, but for when the emperor actually wants to travel around the empire, he has a series of caravans of chariots, and these are half-scale. And the fact that they're half-scale sort of says to me that they're sort of like an app. So, I don't know. Some of them, it's like a mobile phone app. It's for a purpose to go across there. I was carrying this rather heavy weight here. Now, it's these chariots, which were phenomenally high-tech for 300 years before. Okay, hello, thanks a lot. Sorry, it's a lot tougher for you slowing down. Okay, so that was a pedestrian crossing and a bicyclist. And it's sort of like a no-no. For a car, it's easy, but for a bike, you know, you have to. They have to slow down. I sort of know on the side of getting it done. So there's the and these have huge degree of sophistication. So it's here that you see that indeed the charioteer has a crossbow. A bit like the American police will have a shotty or something like that there, and looking pretty serious with his umbrella and various horses. And there's sort of whole terracotta horses, full scale and half scale. I don't know whether they're precisely half scale. Just looking at, I think they're sort of something down, not half, I'd say probably third scale or something like that. But the idea is that of course, the terracotta warriors have to be full scale, but for actually going around sort of like this bizarre brain twisting thing, because it's only afterlife, they are spirits, of course, they don't have to be full size whatsoever. So my entire sort of thought is, well, can't they actually be sub miniature? But no. And so we have the story here that they were pitted, put in a pit, and wooden roof, and then turf, and then greenery over the top of that, an entire entombed thing, a mausoleum, no doubt, no less, and then obviously with a door and stuff like that. Of course, it wasn't like that when they uncovered them. Then when the 50-year-old first chin died. The second chin came along. Now, the interesting thing is that the by then they had sort of seen this happening, and the first son had ideas of his own, which is absolutely forbidden. And he had ideas of softening the iron grip on society. And of course, the iron grip actually suited a lot of people who were acting in the name of the emperor. You can imagine personalities being sucked into that, inflexible personalities. And so they put a fake will of the king, who died unexpectedly. He was having a elixir to make him live forever, killed him. And can you imagine? He definitely wanted his money back from Alibaba. On that particular product. So they said, "Oh look, Dad wants you to commit suicide." What? My dad wants me to? Oh, I better go and commit suicide. So the first son commits suicide. Bit of a count, a bit. He had 50 sons, as you do if you're a big emperor. And son number 18 wasn't that old. So, you know, I find this hard to actually calculate what this all means. But he was the infant king, and of course the Han dynasty. So the Han as a racial group came in, and it's the Han Chinese today. So it's sort of a bit hard to sort of get your mind about. And so the Han Chinese came in and introduced a more soft, caring, a wholesome spirituality. A spirituality which involved the family and spirits and good fortune. And I suppose the idea of fortune came in because one of the things is that the idea of you acting and doing things to create good fortune rather than being directed came across, so you could see that. So when they came, they burnt the chambers. They all crushed. Now, by crushing them is sort of like the ultimate way to preserve them, isn't it? You heat them up and crush them, it all burns, it's all smashed, so no one loots it or, you know, sells it over hundreds of years. It's all smashed and, you know, it's fucked. And in a certain way, the Han Chinese actually did, by erasing it, wiping it out, made it... preserve it for its current day, because there's no way that something could survive 2,300 years. And we are really scratching to get anything of that ancient ilk. So this is such a huge amount of things. So I find it very interesting that the idea of erasing something actually preserves it. So that's a very interesting aspect to it. And the amount of insight you get into a society for which, you know, I don't know, terror was pretty constant. I sort of see the Mediterranean things in that the ship would come and the ship would go. It's sort of like a more digital influence, whereas in China, where everything is connected by multiple roads, multiple ways, information flows a lot more. I just think the individual arose a lot more with the actual geography. In that you'd be left on an island for an awful long time to your own devices. So it sort of mediated the basic terror formula for which human society grew. So that's just my insights. And that's my view of the Tim Warriors. And if For me, it's more an exercise in remembering and recounting things. Thanks a lot for listening. Magnets and Magnetic Fields 101. This will be a short podcast. So it's come to pass that I've been chatting with people. I sort of really expect teachers not to really understand the basics of magnetic fields. What has surprised me is that the memo of what magnetic fields are really like hasn't actually reached professors, and there's nothing against that. It's just it means that there's a lot of work to do here. So you'd probably be told that there's such thing as a magnetic field, there's such thing as magnetic field lines, there's such things as magnetic monopoles, although no one's ever found them, but they're very good for teaching. A magnetic monopole would be an isolated north pole without an associated south pole, and you'd be told that magnetic field lines trace the direction of force of a north pole, so a north monopole. So if you place a north monopole on the north of a north-south dipole, it would be repelled, and if it was very massive, it would slowly make its way along the field lines until it came back to the original point. And as such, magnetic field lines are lines of practical thickness, of a practical trajectory of a very massive object, say like the Titanic, would have a magnetic monopole. Now, magnetic monopoles don't exist, and this is just an arbitrary way of describing something. So what is a magnetic field? A field is basically a number. It's a three-dimensional number, and it's a number that describes quantity. A field describes quantity across space. So a magnetic field just describes the magnetic moment that a object would have. And now we actually don't have magnetic monopoles. They don't exist. They are really nonsensical. They are nonsense. I can say that. You can have some bizarre geometries which destroy space-time. So magnetic field is electric field seen from a different frame of reference, from a high-speed frame of reference, if you will. And, of course, things are stationary because high-speed has actually been folded into physical objects, physical space. I'm just coming across here. So monopoles don't exist, dipoles do exist, and a dipole will do two things inside a magnetic field. So I've got a magnet and it's projecting its influence out through space, and the mathematical description of that influence is called a magnetic field. So magnetic field is like a description. So I don't know, sort of panic in a crowd you can see panic in a crowd, people shout and scream and run and stuff like that, but that panic is not a physical thing, it's a response, it's a description. You can actually draw a line on a monitor indicating people who are working and not working. Oh, I'm going to finish this bloody soon coming through here. So I wasn't realizing how quick it is to get to the gym to describe it. So in a magnetic field, things either a dipole, there's two things. One is it has a torque. Dipole has a torque, and a dipole has a force in a gradient. And so, in effect, north is attracted to north. That is, a north dipole is attracted to a dipole field. A magnetic field is a dipole field, and it has effect as a dipole field. It has effect, a force effect on dipoles. So really, the entire thing of magnetic field lines is that if you draw them, they actually never stop. They go in a loop. So you can't have a monopole implies a magnetic field potential energy coming across here, magnetic field potential energy, and it looks as though I'm going to have this gym to myself. So I've just got to remember the fact that I'll do a recap on this after I do this gym exercise for, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 hours of gym work ahead of me go ahead. Look, am I making progress? I can't tell. I'm making some 1% progress, going 1% forward, 1% back now, doing this cognitive gym work. I've gone from 23% first off to 70%, of the population. So in a room, you give the gold, silver, bronze, and I'd be the person who misses out out there in terms of being at the 70%. But I was a lot worse. Now, I don't know whether that actually means anything, and I can sort of see my skill level just plateau and not improve. But I'll just keep on doing it. So what we're going to do is I'll come back to this podcast and actually really bury into magnetic field lines to see if we can understand that. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.